Would you say that you're the pursuer or the distancer in your relationship?
I would be the distancer. I'm 100% sure of that.
Do you agree to that?
100%.
Would you consider yourself the pursuer or the distancer in your relationship?
I would say the distancer.
In different relationships, I think I clearly play different roles. There's relationships where I've been the distancer, ironically, when the man is more pursuing.
Would you say that you're the pursuer or the distancer in your relationship?
Pursuer.
I would say I'm the distancer.
In certain parts of life, I'm the pursuer, and in others, I'm the distancer. So, sadly, it's both.
Most couples can relate to the dynamic of one person wanting more closeness and the other needing more space. So many of the conflicts we see between couples involve one person feeling like they're not getting something from the other and the other person feeling defensive or overwhelmed. Psychologists often refer to this as the pursuer-distancer dynamic. It's a pretty common pattern that we hear a lot about on PsychAlive. We can also see it in our friends' relationships or even relate to it in our own. The scope of the impact of the pursuer-distancer dynamic can be powerful. In fact, a study of 1,400 individuals over 30 years done by relationship researcher Eve Mavis Hetherington found that couples who were stuck in this mode were actually at the highest risk for divorce. But why is this such a common pattern? Why is it that so many couples can't seem to get close because one is always pushing and the other is always pulling? Why do we maintain this distance in our relationships when what we say we want is to be close? So here we are, our first podcast.
Our first podcast.
I'm Lena Firestone, the new media director at PsychAlive.
And I'm Carolyn Firestone, a senior editor at PsychAlive. For those of you joining us, this podcast is brought to you by PsychAlive, a nonprofit website created to bring insightful and empowering psychological information to the public.
We call our podcast Why Do We? Because we want to dive in and explore and explain topics that have to do with our own behavior as human beings. Why are we so hard on ourselves? Why do we get insecure? Why do we pull away in relationships? Why do we feel so anxious about our kids?
A lot of the time we'll be focusing this podcast on questions that we get straight from you, questions that we hear on PsychAlive, comments that are left on some of our blogs. So we hope to shed light on some of the subjects that really matter to you and that impact you in your daily life.
And today we're asking the question, why do we push and pull in our relationships?
To help answer that, we'll be joined by our sister, Lisa Firestone, who is a clinical psychologist, the co-author of Sex and Love and Intimate Relationships, among other books. She's the director of research and education at the Glendon Association, and she's also a senior editor here at PsychAlive.
And she's our own personal encyclopedia for all things mental health. So Lisa, you've written about the pursuer-distancer dynamic. Do the results of Hetherington's study surprise you that it's actually the leading cause for divorce?
No, I see it as one of the main problems for couples. And what happens in that situation is the distancer pursuer has a lot of chemistry at the beginning. So often there's a lot of passion, a lot of draw to each other, along with very painful moments and episodes because both are getting hurt all the time by the other's defenses. But eventually those same things that they were drawn to, like the faraway look in his eyes or the fact that she's asking a million questions, that's what they're really resentful of when they come into therapy. You know, why does she have to know everything about me? Why can't she just let me chill after work? And, you know, how can he not connect with me when he comes home? And, you know, he still wants his distance and he just wants to turn on the TV. You know, it's the same things that drew them together that they're now complaining about. And with a pursuer and distancer relationship, they're going to often get to a divorce point at some point because they start to drive each other crazy. Because when you've got one of them being a pursuer, they're going to be all the time, how can I get this person to love me? And that anxiety never really gets quelled in them the way it would if they would hook up with somebody who really wanted to meet their needs.
When people do make these choices and they wind up in a relationship with someone who they either feel like they have to keep going after or who they have to keep kind of keeping at a distance, how do they see each other?
Well, the person who is a distancer is often perceiving the other person as very needy. They don't really understand what it is the other person's wanting and needing because they've got so removed from their own wants and needs. They see other people as somehow hungry, needy, disorderly, childlike. And they see themselves as more adult and grown up, and they tend to really see all their faults. You know, they hyper pay attention to all the ways their partner is a bit childlike, which you could probably say about any of us in some ways, right? Not so organized or having all these messy emotions that, you know, who really needs all that? Connecting with them, time with them, looking in their eyes. What are you talking about? That's all silliness. The person who is more preoccupied and anxious is seeing their partner often as unavailable to them, not paying enough attention to them, not reassuring them enough. They often see them as kind of cold and removed, and they, again, may be critical of how much they work or how disregarding they are of the kids. You know, you don't give our kids any attention either. They may start to see that person more in terms of a parent that they had that was unavailable to them. They tend to do a lot of projecting onto each other. But again, they're paying attention to the faults. They're not seeing the acts when their partner actually is there for them or the little bits of kindness that they may pay to them. They kind of like, oh yeah, that was good, but where's the next one? You know, they don't really linger or pay attention to them. And what I found, at least by the time couples get to come see me, is they're pretty honed in on all the negative about their partner. They're often quite a bit less insightful about their own issues in the relationship. But sometimes at some point, they've gotten to a point where they're willing to be a little bit more vulnerable or open, and that's partly why they show up at my door, because they do want something different.
Are people usually pretty good at recognizing these patterns in themselves, or is it confusing to them?
I think it's confusing to them. I think they tend to want to label themselves and their partner and say, oh, I know who's the distancer and the pursuer. But it'd be interesting to look at, for everybody, no matter who you think you are or who you think your partner is, what are the ways you distance and what are the ways that you pursue that are not constructive?
You've often said people come by their defenses or these patterns honestly. What do you think goes into a person becoming either a distancer or a pursuer in their relationship?
Often people who grew up feeling like the best way of getting their needs met was not having any, because what happened to them early on is they wanted something or they had a need. And if you're a baby and you want to have a need, you cry. And hopefully the people that are around you respond. And if they do, and even if they don't get it exactly right, but you keep crying and they try something else and then it works, you learn that it's okay to express your needs, that if you do, they get met. And you feel comfortable having needs. But what happens for some people is that they express and nothing happens, and they express and nothing happens. And what happens is they learn it's really painful to have needs. So better not to have any, or at least not to act like I have any, because, you know, the people around me do a good enough job. They keep me alive. They feed me eventually. They keep me warm enough. I survive. So when those people grow up, they often look like distancers. They act like they don't have any needs, and they actually really don't have the sense of having them. And they feel overwhelmed by people who seem to have them. So when they get involved with somebody who does have needs, maybe hyper attuned to their own needs, they tend to denigrate their neediness. You know, they're so needy. Why do they want to be so close to me? I also think that just in general, we've put up a lot of psychological defenses, whether we had that childhood or another one that led us to develop sort of being wary of letting people in. Somebody who just likes you and really wants to be with you can seem quite boring, actually. And it's easy to focus on all the things that aren't exciting about them. You know, that's often because the people we go for, the people we're drawn to, their defenses fit with ours. So if you aren't in touch with your needs and you feel kind of overwhelmed by people who are, or not particularly drawn to people who want to give you things or do things for you or be close to you or love you, often what you are drawn to is somebody who needs quite a bit, actually, so that you can then say, see how needy they are. And so that you can then feel like, oh, yes, I need to protect myself because they just want too much. So it supports your idea of how to do life. Once we develop these ideas of how to do life, which we develop in our families, we tend to then want to stay with those particular defenses. They feel very comfortable. It feels like the way to relate. And that's why that person is often going to be with somebody who, on the other hand, is saying, I need more closeness. What are you doing? I want to be with you more. Why can't you be with me? Why can't you pay attention to me? And what that person has learned as a child, they had a very different sort of interaction with their caretakers, where their caretakers would sometimes be there and give them what they needed. But it was intermittent reinforcement, if you will, because sometimes they would not be there when you needed them. And sometimes they would actually be acting out of their need. So they would, you know, grab you up and give you a hug when they needed a hug, not because you needed a hug. And when you've had that kind of childhood, what you learn to do is be very preoccupied. Keep an eye on your caretaker at all time, because if you just kind of cling, you'll probably get your needs met. Mm-hmm. And that's a good adaptation when you're a child. When you do that in your adult relationships, it looks to other people like you're needy. You're wanting more of them, and you're also needing a lot of reassurance. See, neither person, the person who has learned to be avoidant and not in touch with their own needs, or the person who has learned to pay exquisite attention to their needs and to demand to get them met, neither of them feels very good about themselves. Mm. You know, and it's not that they've developed this really good self-esteem or feeling about themselves. So the person who's needy feels like they need to be reassured all the time, because do you like me? Maybe you like me? Could you like me? You know, I've got to figure it out all the time. So they need a lot of reassurance. The person who feels like they don't have any needs sort of feels like that's part of why they're suspicious of people who love them and want them. It's like, wait a minute, what's wrong with you? If you like me, there must be something wrong with you, because I'm not desirable. So it's not that they feel great about themselves either. They may look more confident on the outside because they act like they don't need anybody and they can just take care of it themselves, but they're actually pretty afraid to depend on anybody else to meet a need.
It's so interesting, because I would think someone who has a lot of emotional needs and that strong, strong desire for closeness would really seek out a partner who would fulfill those needs, because that's such a high priority. And someone who really didn't want much in a relationship, you'd think that they would try to find someone who wasn't going to want too much either, so they could kind of just live a peaceful, not too connected life together.
Right. And sometimes people do end up doing that, but they usually do it not because they're as drawn. When there's a lot of chemistry at the beginning, it's usually that other dynamic.
So should people be a little bit suspicious of those initial crazy strong attractions?
Yes. Yes, they're really fun at the beginning, but they're often with a lot of tumultuousness from the beginning, a lot of conflict. When you're feeling magnetically drawn to somebody, it might not be because they're the best person for you. It might be because the way they are fits with the way you feel, and you have to keep doing your thing. Partly the person who's needy needs to feel needy, but they don't want to see that their parents were inadequate. So I have all these needs, so I need to find somebody who's really good at fulfilling them. No, they need to reprove their childhood all over again. So if they go for somebody who is more avoidant and not able to meet their needs, that feels very comfortable. It feels painful and miserable, but in a very familiar way that doesn't have to mess with their own self-image of not being really lovable. It doesn't mess with their idealization of their parents as giving them more than they were able to, really. And idealizing your parents is a funny thing, because people think it means thinking your parents were saints or something. But it doesn't. It just means thinking that you got more than you did. If you find somebody who does a much better job of meeting your needs than they did, that breaks the connection to them. The fantasy or illusion that where you're still connected to them, that originally was life-saving feeling, and feels like it's, you know, life or death to lose now. So even though it seems counterintuitive, we choose people where those defenses, either pulling away from people or going toward them, are adaptive. Not somebody where it's just an easy give and take and what everybody says they would want.
Does having those relationships or those patterns repeat in relationships, does that solidify some of those defenses?
Yeah, it makes your defenses seem more right, because this partner was like that and I had to be like really nudgy to get them to pay any attention to me.
I think you wrote that there can almost be a seesaw where one person's pursuing and the other person's distancing, and that's usually the general pattern where one has one side more in them based on
their childhood.
But why, even when it sort of starts to shift the other way, is there still that space?
I think because they both still have their defenses and they're both still afraid of really being close. But when your partner all of a sudden moves away, who's been preoccupied, it's like, wait, where did all that go? all that things that you were supposedly complaining about and didn't like, wait a minute, where'd they go? You know, and then you go toward that to keep that psychological distance. But if that person starts moving back toward you, you often back up. So this is the push-pull of people. And this is a pattern I've seen a lot of getting together and then breaking up and getting back together and getting up and never really losing that fixation or preoccupation with each other. And part of that can be based on good things that are really could be good in the relationship, that they were really attracted to this person, there's things they liked about them. But the minute they're in the relationship, they forget about those things. And what they focus on are more of these pursuing and distancing things, even though the person might be a fine choice otherwise. And so I think that the reason that they keep the same distance is because of fear of really being intimate on both parts. Pursuers and distancers are both afraid of being close. So it's not that fear of intimacy is just about this pursuer-distancer thing. Both of those are ways of keeping your distance. Because if you're a pursuer, you're pushing the other person to move away from you. And if you're a distancer, you're, you know, drawing that person toward you to a point, but with a safe distance. So I think the underlying issue for all of us is, can we really tolerate love? You know, everybody says they want it, but it's a whole nother thing to try to really let it in. And it means changing your feeling about yourself, feeling like a nice person, which most people don't exactly feel like they're good or nice. And it means allowing somebody to really be in your own personal space and be vulnerable to that. Putting your goodwill in their hands, in a sense, really letting them in on a deep level. And I think most people are afraid of that. I also think that when you're really emotionally close, it brings up the other thing that we fear as human beings, which is other than being hurt by other people, is we fear, you know, death, deterioration, and dying, you know, the existential issues. And when you're really close to another person, it brings up that fear of, what if something happened to them? What if something happened to me? Now I value my life. I don't want to lose it. All those kind of feelings. So a very poignant, close moment is often followed by distance on both parts because it's scary and it does bring up those other deeper issues that we really don't like to think about, our feelings about those. And we've developed throughout our lifetime defenses to keep those at bay. And now we're letting somebody in and we're valuing our life and we're feeling, you know, a way we never felt before. And it's like, it's really terrifying, actually.
It's fascinating to me what you're saying because, in a way, for both people, the pursuer and the distancer, the aim is really to create distance. Even the person desperately trying to get closer to the person is doing it in such a way that is only going to serve the result of pushing them away.
Right, because if you're a logical person, I mean, at some point you've got to go, I do this, they move away. What if I just didn't do that and just made a warm, friendly atmosphere? You know, maybe they'd come toward me. And as much as people can say, okay, I get that, I should try to do that, they're terrified to actually do it. Why are they so resistant to actually doing it? Not because they don't want closeness, but because they're afraid of it too. So if you were a smart pursuer, you go, well, wait a minute, this strategy isn't working, I gotta do something else. But people do the same thing expecting a different result because they're actually comfortable with that result, even though it's not so positive.
For anyone who's listening to this that's already in a relationship and recognizes this pursuer, distancer dynamic going on in their relationship, what would be your advice to them? Is it a hopeless scenario where they should just try to find someone with a different built-in dynamic or attachment style? Or are there things they could do to challenge it?
Yeah, it's almost never a hopeless dynamic. I mean, there are some people that are actually making you more mentally ill to be with. You find your mental health deteriorating. And those are relationships worth getting out of. If you're finding yourself not functioning well in your career and not functioning well in terms of your children or in terms of your other friendships, then you might want to think about it. So there's some relationships. I don't think the relationship should always be put first before the people. I want the human beings to survive. But most things about learning to be better in relationships are better learned by being in a relationship. So if you find yourself in a relationship that's less than perfect, which, by the way, is most relationships, this does not make you unusual. But if you find yourself in a pursuer-distancer relationship, it's actually a great place to work on the dynamic because if you shift, your partner will shift. And that's the thing people always forget. They want to change their partner, and they want often me as a therapist to change their partner who isn't in my office. But what they don't know is that they can shift the dynamic. So if you're a distancer, one of the things you can do is you challenge yourself to allow a bit more closeness with your partner, be a little bit more open, be a little warmer, give a little more support. See if that doesn't take the edge off their anxiety and their neediness. If you're the anxious pursuer who's preoccupied with your partner, you can work on managing your own anxiety, learning some techniques to help yourself calm down. Meditation can be really helpful for that. There's other things as well. And then, especially when there's conflict with your partner, to pursue them when you've got after you've gotten yourself really in a calm state, perhaps by going for a run or, again, listening to some music you really like or, again, meditating, but doing something that helps you get really calm and centered, and then approaching your partner about it and really trying to wait long enough to actually listen to what they say, not, wait, what did you say? No, you don't really feel that way. Well, you know, the thing that anxious people do. But really try to be calm and listen. You know, distancers can do that too, to try to calm themselves and listen and be available to draw their partner out. And then, you know, if you really shift your behavior and your partner doesn't shift, they may no longer be a fit for you because now you've developed more inner security, which you can also do by working on your attachment issues yourself. And you can do that in psychotherapy, obviously, but you can also do it through the process of trying to create a coherent narrative and make sense out of what really happened.
If you're not in a relationship and you know you've had these patterns in the past, what do you think you should look for in a partner? Should you try to find someone with a more secure attachment pattern?
Yeah, the answer for anybody, no matter what your attachment style is to get into a relationship with somebody who's secure, whether you are or not, because that person will eventually put you at peace. It will calm down your fears, whether it's because you're anxious about whether they really love you because you're the pursuer, or whether you're the distancer who needs space. If that person's just calm and can kind of hold their own and state directly what they want and need from you but not get over emotional about it, you eventually learn to tolerate more too.
To actually break this pattern, you almost have to go against your own instincts sometimes. And one of the things that, like, we've heard even just in talking to friends at times when they've been on one side or the other of this, is you say, like, well, if the person feels pulled on or like you're being aggressive, why don't you kind of relax? Like what you just said, like, you know, just try to just like live your life. And they say, well, I don't want to play a game. So it's kind of interesting because it seems like sometimes people, they justify those behaviors by feeling like it's being inauthentic or something like that.
Right. Like authentically, I need distance or authentically, I need connection. Yeah. I think that's when you have to use your mind and take a step back from your feelings and go, okay, this is how I feel, but what is it I really want in my life? And this is where having a goal-directed life is important and goals for your relationship. So if you want to be closer and you keep doing this thing that feels authentic to you, but it's not getting you that, maybe it's a defense. And our defenses feel very authentic to us. They feel exactly like the right thing to do. Partly because they were adaptations that at one time helped keep us alive, made life work better. Because they were adaptive when we were kids. People don't develop defenses because they want to have defenses. They develop them because they had to make adaptations to make life work from the beginning. So they still have that authentic life-saving quality to them. But they may not be who you were if you didn't get messed with. And it's not a matter of playing a game. It's a matter of trying a different behavior. And yes, maybe being a bit strategic to try to get the things that you want in life. But also challenging yourself, seeing what it feels like to be different, to try on a new behavior. And see whether it resonates with you. I mean, any new thing that you do is not something that was authentically you from the beginning. It's new. So you start exercising. That might feel really awkward to you at first or whatever, but, you know, it might end up being a really good and healthy thing that you actually feel good from.
Apart from getting into a relationship with someone who has a more secure attachment and is able to be more present and offering you to meet your needs, are there things they can do to become more secure in themselves so that the relationship itself will work better?
Right. Well, first of all, they could work on developing what's called earned secure attachment. And they could do it by working on creating a coherent narrative. We actually have an e-course to help people do that I did with Dan Siegel. But also, it might require getting into therapy and working on your issues. In both cases, the individuals have unresolved issues from their own past. Because the best predictor of insecure attachment is having unresolved trauma and loss in your life. So the thing you can do is you can work on resolving those issues. What was the pain of your childhood? What did that look like? Making sense of it, breaking the idealization of your parents, which doesn't mean demonizing them either. It just means seeing them as a real person who had strengths and weaknesses. Even if they were, quotes, fine parents because they gave you a good education and put food on the table at all times and things like that, that there was probably things that hurt you and bent you out of shape. And it's worth looking at those things.
When people challenge these patterns in themselves, what comes up in them?
If you do something that feels out of character to you and challenge these defenses, makes you uncomfortable. It makes you anxious. You know, you develop these patterns for a good reason and they feel really comfortable and you know how to do them. Now you're asking yourself to do something you don't know how to do, feels really uncomfortable, and you don't know what the result's going to be. So you're going to feel anxious and scared. And probably initially, at least, you're going to have a lot of critical inner voices come up. What are you doing? That's not really you. You look so phony. Yeah, you're acting like you're not needy, but you really are. And you know you're really not going to get anything unless you make sure you get something, you know, or whatever. The voices get louder initially. But if you can stay with the behavior, it'll start to feel more comfortable. And then you just have more choices. You have more options. You know, we put ourselves in these little boxes of this is me, and this is how I do things, and this is how I think, and this is how I can be. And the truth is, that's a pretty limited view of you. And it's worth doing some of these really uncomfortable things to see how you feel. And especially when you let somebody within that emotional buffer zone and you get a bit closer, it's going to feel really scary. But if you can sort of stick with it, you can get more comfortable with letting more love in your life. And if you're willing to do that work, you know, your partner will shift and the relationship will shift. Or eventually you'll get a different partner.
Thank you so much for letting us interview you.
Thank you.
This is fun. I like this. It's interesting to talk about these things because they're interesting. And I think they are things that people really have a hard time with and don't understand. And I mean, it's sad because people could have so much more.
Why Do We is produced by PsychAlive and the Glendon Association. You can listen to more episodes or subscribe at PsychAlive.org or wherever you find your podcasts.